Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello and welcome to ID the Future. This is Annika Smith broadcasting with the CSC in Seattle. And today we have on Robert Dees, who had a great article at ARN's ID Update on spontaneous generation. Robert, can you tell us just a little bit about what spontaneous generation is when historians of science talk about it? I mean, I have visions of maggots coming from meat in my mind, but I don't know what our listeners have the base image as. So
historically, spontaneous generation was a reality that seemed to accord well with scientific observation. So it was thought that organisms could they could appear really in a mature form, as it were, without any development from young to adult. So there was one review that I read recently that said of spontaneous generation that it was the idea that new life could form from decaying matter. So really, yes, it's exactly as you said. It was the idea that you could get maggots growing in meat without any, you know, any other organism coming into contact with the meat. So that was, yeah, that was how things were seen in the 17th century.
Wow, that's strange to our modern mind a little bit. But what was there any scientific evidence or any experiments that would support those claims when this theory was around?
Yeah, so there were many experiments that were done at that time. Actually, the idea of spontaneous generation goes back through the centuries. I mean, it wasn't just in the 17th century that it was considered to be a reality. It was really something that was I would say considered a given. And there were many experiments. One of the big spontaneous generationists of the 17th century was Jan Baptista van Helmont, who did an experiment where he put leaves together in damp conditions, and what he generated were long eels. He saw these long strands coming out of the leaves, and he thought of these as long eels. And of course, we now know that these are in fact the hyphae that come from fungal growth. But then there were other experiments that were done with rats and garbage mounds where again rats appeared to just appear out of nowhere in a mound of garbage. There was even a recipe that anyone could do that involved taking a dirty garment, adding some wheat to it, and letting the mixture ferment for a few hours, and then you'd see mice. Now obviously the mice hadn't come from the garment, but at that time it was considered that yes, you could just get mice out of dirty garments, as it were. So, and now obviously we know that that's not the case, but it was really considered to be the reality of the situation that was under investigation. So, then once people like the Jesuit trained doctor Francesco Redi and Louis Pasteur, they were really the ones who started challenging this point of view, and they did some scientifically sound experiments. For Francesco Redi, it was a muslin covered piece of meat, and there he demonstrated that maggots couldn't just spontaneously arise in the meat. There was something else that was seeding their existence, and we know of course now that it was flies that would land on the meat and lay their eggs. And Louis Pasteur, he did some experiments with flasks. He took these flasks to the Parisian polluted air and saw that in these flasks, which he had placed medium in, he would get contamination of the medium so relatively quickly. Whereas when he went up into the Alps, he didn't get such a quick contamination. So once again, his experiments really demonstrated that there was something in the air that was contaminating the media. It wasn't something that was spontaneously generating in the medium itself.
And why was this theory so popular philosophically? And what were the theories that it sort of stood against at the time? What drove the spontaneous generationists to search for this explanation?
Well, there was the impetus for most of this. I mean, the spontaneous generationists really thought that they had a sound scientific claim. They were doing what scientists do, which is they were setting up experiments, and they were so they were recording observations, mm-hmm. and really they were, you know, they really were, I would say, fairly well convinced that this was what was happening. Now, what happened for Redi and Louis Pasteur, they actually initially had a theological reason for going against this, because they believed, well, you know, that in the creation, God, as author of life, had created life, and therefore if the spontaneous generationists were correct in what they were assuming, then you know, God as the author of life would no longer be needed. So Redi and Pasteur really had a theological conviction that led them initially to go against the spontaneous generationists, and of course they were then able to confirm their suspicions through their own experiments.
So their own philosophical intuition, I guess, about it, led them to fruitful scientific discovery. That's very interesting.
Yes, exactly. That is exactly correct.
How has the term spontaneous generation sort of been redefined today, and what are we seeing? I mean, obviously, people don't expect mice to come out of dirty clothes and vinegar, but what are people, where is this pattern sort of being repeated?
Well, if we look, actually, I was reading a book, the title of which is, I mean, it's a fairly well-known book, that has really expanded this definition of spontaneous generation, and the book title is Of Pandas and People. And what we see in that book, and we've seen it elsewhere as well, is the expansion of the definition of spontaneous generation to encompass any idea that life arose from organic matter, that, you know, that even the contemporary view of evolutionists that life originated billions of years ago from some yet to be defined concoction of prebiotic compounds. So again, it's this idea that life just got going out of some organic soup. So the most outspoken of the new crop of spontaneous generationists, as it were, is of course our well-known zoologist Richard Dawkins, who, you know, who has written extensively in books such as The Selfish Gene, and has expounded the idea that really, yes, there is nothing more to it, that life just arose out of some prebiotic soup, and that natural selection then took on the role, as it were, of, you know, selecting from that concoction, to give the molecules that then survived and developed into the original cell. So that's really where the definition has been expanded today.
And I assume there are experiments going on, just as the spontaneous generations of the 17th century had. What experiments today attempt to have that same sort of origin of life simulation in that naturalistic way?
Right, yeah. So there have been a lot of experiments that have been done in the lab, and this is a critical point, because the lab is obviously not what we're finding outside in the earthly environment. And what is notable about these experiments is that they're very much controlled. They tend to focus on a few reagents that are then, you know, they are in a designed environment, as it were, and the investigators that are doing these experiments are guiding the reactions towards the desired outcome of chemical products. So, you know, we have to be skeptical.
Right. Well,
about
that's no longer naturalistic at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's really, you know, it really is demonstrating exactly the opposite. It's demonstrating the requirement for investigators to take their reactions towards a desired outcome. And that is really where a lot of people are now very skeptical about these experiments, even though they continue today. So I would say that the evidence is really pointing to intelligent design in many of these experiments and not the spontaneous generation of life.
Wow, very interesting. Do you have hope that these origin of life experiments might point further in development for the case for ID or even convince people, and we can learn from Pasteur and others earlier who had to be very patient with their contemporaries because they weren't convinced immediately that spontaneous generation didn't work for getting mice out of garments and whatnot.
Right.
What would you take from that as far as encouragement to a young ID scientist today?
So I would say that, you know, that really we have to press on. We have to continue looking at the evidence, seeing where it leads us to. I mean, one of the more recent experiments that was done was the creation of what one might call a basic cell. There was an experiment that was done, I believe it was about 2 or 3 years ago, where a cell made up of layers of rubber, as it were, that were in somehow simulating cellular vesicles and cellular compartments, was put together with a computer chip. And once again, the demonstration from this experiment was that there is a need for carefully executed instructions and fine-tuned conditions for life processes such as and protein synthesis to occur. So, you know, the evidence really is there, and for the young ID scientist, for somebody who's kicking the tires of ID, they can look at that evidence and say, yes, you know, that really does support the ID proponent point of view. There are numerous books out there in the literature, in the bookstores, and one of the ones that I've really liked is one that was written last year by the biochemist Fazali Rana, who demonstrated very clearly in his book that, you know, there is this need within the cell for a very exacting environment for life processes to occur. So again, the evidence is there, and biology today is demonstrating that very clearly. So I think, you know, there's a lot to go for the ID argument, and anybody who's new to the field should be greatly encouraged by the evidence.
Wow, well, that's really good news and exciting to learn about. Thank you so much for being with us, Robert. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
For ID the Future, this is Annika Smith with the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.